Coming up, Benedict XVI in the Holy Land. The Pope preaches peace amid the complexities of Muslim, Jewish, Christian relations. And a mother going on trial charged with reckless homicide for the death of her daughter. She and her husband trusted in God's healing power alone and did not take their sick child to a doctor.
It's sort of a hidden tragedy in communities that are not part of mainstream America. We just don't know what's happening to the kids in those church communities.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. The Holy Land is again the center of intense diplomatic activity. The Pope ended his visit there as Israel's new Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, prepared to come to Washington next week. He'll be followed by the Palestinian leader, Mahmoud Abbas, and then by Egypt's President Hosni Mubarak. President Obama announced that he will give his promised speech on U.S.-Muslim relations in Egypt next month. Kim Lawton covered the Pope's trip and has a report from Jerusalem.
From the moment he arrived in Israel, Pope Benedict XVI made peace his central theme. Benedict said over and over again that this was a spiritual pilgrimage, not a political mission. Yet he couldn't avoid the complicated politics of this land. The Pope expressed his support for a two-state solution for Palestinians and Israelis, something Israel's new government has yet to commit to. Many Palestinians were especially pleased the Pope visited the Aida refugee camp near Bethlehem. There, he criticized the huge concrete security wall, built, the Israelis say, to keep out suicide bombers. And while he endorsed the creation of an independent Palestinian state, he also urged Palestinian youth not to resort to acts of terrorism.
Every step that the Pope takes on in every place he goes, including Temple Mount or the Western Wall, is a gesture of reconciliation to both sides, and he's tried during the week he's here to play a balancing act, and it never quite works out perfect for everybody.
Pilgrims came from around the world to be part of the Pope's visit here, but his main focus was on the local Christians, Jews, and Muslims. The visit certainly encouraged the region's shrinking Christian population. In 1948, Christians made up about 20% of the population here. Today, because of emigration and declining birth rates, they represent less than 2%.
We are worried about the Christians here in Jerusalem and all the Holy Land. To be here is our mission, to be here, to continue to be here in this land.
Benedict urged the Christian population, predominantly Palestinian, to persevere. His support meant a lot to local Christians.
He is the big man, the holy, well, you consider the holy man, and representing the Catholic Church over the world. So for him to come in an area where there's a conflict, very small country, but it's a big issue here, I think it's very important for his visit.
The talk is always about the relationship with the Muslims and the Jews, but it's very important for the Pope to come here to with the relationship with the Christians.
Meanwhile, many Jewish leaders had high expectations that this visit would be a visual demonstration that their community still has strong relations with the Vatican. Despite recent tensions after Benedict lifted the excommunication of a traditionalist bishop who denies the Holocaust.
Most people don't know about statements and declarations. Most people don't read properly, but nevertheless people do view the visual images.
Benedict met with Israel's chief rabbis and visited the Western Wall, where he left a prayer for peace in the Middle East. He also visited Yad Vashem, the Holocaust memorial, but his speech there generated controversy. Some Israelis were upset that he did not acknowledge the role Christian anti-Semitism played in the Holocaust, and he did not refer to his own background as a German growing up in the Nazi era. Vatican spokesman Father Federico Lombardi said the Pope had addressed those points before and didn't feel the need to repeat them.
He had already spoken many times about these problems.
Rabbi Ron Kronis of the Interreligious Coordinating Council of Israel said he believes, overall, the visit was a positive thing for the Jewish community.
It strengthens Israel's place in the family of nations and in the world community. So I think the people are going to be happy about it when they look back. He went to Yad Vashem. He went to the Western Wall. He went to all the right places. He's made all the right gestures that count for both peoples, and I think we ought to not focus on all the things he could have said or not said.
Benedict also did some fence mending with the Muslim community, where tensions linger after his controversial speech in 2006, where he quoted a Byzantine emperor who linked the Prophet Muhammad and violence. Benedict was the first pope to visit the compound of Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock, one of the holiest sites in Islam, and a place of deep contention between Muslims and Jews. Muslim leader Issa Jaber is an Israeli Arab who helps coordinate interfaith dialogue.
We believe that His Holiness' visit to the Mosque of Al-Aqsa and the Dome Rock was very important and may open new dimensions of dialogue, a new dialogue between the different religions, especially Islam and Christianity.
But the complexities of interreligious dialogue here were also evident. At an interfaith gathering, Sheikh Tasir Al-Tamimi, an Islamic court judge in the Palestinian Authority, made an impromptu 10-minute-long diatribe against Israeli occupation, prompting some of the Jewish representatives to walk out of the meeting.
Maybe it was not exactly on the agenda of the program, but for Sheikh Tamimi, it was very important to show the Pope and to let him understand the pains of the Palestinian people in Jerusalem and outside of Jerusalem.
It demonstrated our reality here. And if things were simple and the religions could easily get together and meet together without any problems, we would already have peace.
Ilana Rosamond is part of an interfaith movement called the Abrahamic Reunion, which seeks to build personal relationships and trust among people of the three major religions.
Yes, the reality of conflict and war and killing exists daily. Right now, people are being victims of violent acts here. We know that. But also, there is another level of reality that exists, of peaceful, harmonious, loving relationships between Muslims, Christians, and Jews.
She works closely with her friends Eliyahu McLean, a fellow Jew, and Ibrahim Ahmad Abu al-Hawa, a Muslim.
We are stubborn people,
stubborn,
because
stubborn.
We are the children of Abraham. We are from the same seed. Okay.
This is a point that Ibrahim always makes, that God chose two of the most stubborn people in the world, the Arabs and the Jews, to live in this land, and that is actually God's decision. And this is also why it's so difficult to make peace, because we're both very stubborn. But at the same time, we need to be stubborn to be peacemakers.
The three say the Pope's visit encouraged them in their work.
I really felt personally empowered when the Pope gave a specific blessing to the peacemakers, to the Jews and Arabs, Israelis and Palestinians who are working to make a better future for the children of Abraham in the land of the prophets, in the Holy Land.
The Pope may have urged the religious community to be a force for peace, but many leaders in the movement for interfaith dialogue acknowledge that politics can't be separated out.
The road ahead is bumpy. It's not a smooth road because we are linked to the political processes. We try to keep a flicker of hope alive in a sometimes desperate situation, and we believe that when the peace process moves forward, we will be able to move in cooperation with governments in bigger and more systematic ways in the future.
Benedict prayed for peace at every stop in this week-long Holy Land pilgrimage, and in spite of everything else, Christians, Muslims, and Jews alike said they hope that message of peace will be the ultimate legacy of this trip. I'm Kim Lawton in Jerusalem.
Also this week, the controversy at Notre Dame. Should a Catholic university honor a president whose views on abortion differ from the teachings of the Catholic Church? All week outside the Notre Dame campus, protesters condemned the university's invitation to President Obama to give its commencement address this weekend and receive an honorary degree. Earlier in Washington at the National Catholic Prayer Breakfast, former Archbishop of St. Louis Raymond Burke, a strong abortion opponent and now a Vatican official, sharply criticized Notre Dame.
The proposed granting of an honorary doctorate at Notre Dame University to our president, who is so aggressively advancing an anti-life and anti-family agenda, is rightly the source of the greatest scandal.
While Archbishop Burke received a standing ovation, many other Catholics noted that Notre Dame has been inviting presidents to its campus since the days of Dwight Eisenhower. That's part of academic freedom, says Father Thomas Reese of Georgetown University.
I don't think it's a scandal. Universities should be places where we have discussion, debate, where people of different views come together to argue. And when the bishops get involved in trying to censor people, ban speakers, I think it's not helpful.
This is a Catholic institution which is bound by its title as Catholic, its identity as Catholic, to uphold the moral law, and that's the source of the scandal.
If you ban people from your campus, if you censor people, it comes across as an acknowledgement that you don't really have good arguments that are convincing to either your students
really
or that can win in a debate over these issues.
For his part, at a news conference last month, Obama sought common ground.
I believe that women should have the right to choose, but I think that the most important thing we can do to tamp down some of the anger surrounding this issue is to focus on those areas that we can agree on.
Back at Notre Dame, Professor Scott Appleby saw a bright side.
One result of the president coming to commencement is there's a vigorous public debate and discussion about life issues. Well, that's a victory, really, for a university.
Many of the protesters at Notre Dame were well-known anti-abortion activists from around the country, but their views do not represent the opinions of most Catholics. According to a Pew Research survey, 50% of American Catholics approve of Notre Dame's invitation, 28% do not. New Hampshire is likely to become the next state to allow same-sex marriages. The governor has said he'll sign a bill to legalize gay marriage as soon as legislators revise a bill they've already approved. The governor wants stronger language to protect churches and their employees from lawsuits. State legislators say they could approve the changes as early as next week. Relief agencies are struggling to help ease the humanitarian crises in Pakistan, Somalia, and Sri Lanka. In Pakistan, renewed battles in the northwest between the Pakistan military and Taliban insurgents have caused as many as 800,000 people to flee the Swat Valley. The UN has warned that in Somalia, escalating violence between the government and rebels could cause the deaths of up to 1.5 million people from violence and starvation within 6 months. And in Sri Lanka, the International Committee of the Red Cross says violence has prevented it from delivering relief supplies and rescuing the wounded. At least 200,000 people have fled continuing clashes between the government and Tamil Tiger rebels. The UN has called the fighting a bloodbath. 50,000 civilians remain trapped in the war zone. The American freelance journalist convicted in Iran last month of spying for the U.S. is on her way home. 32-year-old Roxana Saberi was reunited with her parents outside an Iranian prison after an appeals court reduced and suspended her 8-year prison sentence. Since her arrest in January, Lutheran and other religious leaders had called for Saberi's release. She's a graduate of Concordia College, a Lutheran school in Minnesota. The school's president called her release a day to celebrate. A new report says nearly 4 in 10 births in the United States are to unmarried women. The report from the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said 1.7 million unmarried women gave birth in the U.S. in 2007. That's a 4% increase over the previous year and 2.5 times the number reported in 1980. The percentages are higher in Northern Europe. In Iceland, 6 in 10 births occur to unmarried women, as do more than half of all births in Sweden and Norway. This week in Wausau, Wisconsin, jury selection began in the trial of a mother charged with reckless homicide. She relied only on God, not a doctor, to heal her sick daughter. The girl died. The mother was a member of a sect that teaches reliance on faith and prayer alone to heal. She was not a Christian Scientist, which does not forbid medical treatment. Christian Scientists are also active in trying to create legislation that balances the state's duty to protect children with parents' trust in God. But should there be any exemptions from prosecution because of religious faith? Lucky Severson reports.
The 911 call was from Karen Newman's mom by Kara's bedside at home in Wisconsin.
Now, just feel by her nose and see if she's breathing.
Okay, yeah, let me
feel
see.
The air.
Okay, is she breathing? Is she breathing? Is she breathing?
No.
No, she's not.
It was too late to save the 11-year-old girl suffering from juvenile diabetes. Dr. Norman Faust, a pediatrician and ethicist at the University of Wisconsin, says her death could have been prevented.
Millions of Americans have diabetes, and most children with diabetes are living reasonably normal lives. There are complications later in life, so that life expectancy may be curtailed. But Kara Newman had many, many decades of happy life ahead of her.
Dr. Foss says he has seen many kids, like Kara, often suffer and die needlessly because their parents refused to take them to a doctor and instead put their faith in the healing power of prayer. The Newmans reportedly subscribe to the teachings of Unleavened Bread Ministries, an online religion. University of Wisconsin religion professor Sean Peters says there are a surprising number of religious groups that preach faith healing based on a literal interpretation of the Bible and a fervent belief in the power of a loving God. Peters authored a book called When Prayer Fails.
They looked at passages from books of the Bible, such as the Epistle of James. Fifth chapter of James has this passage that begins, "Are any among you sick?" And then it seems to spell out treatment. It's treatment that doesn't include secular medicine. It's treatment that includes prayer and anointment with oil.
In a small private graveyard in a Portland, Oregon suburb, there are at least 75 tombstones of children whose parents belong to a small church called the Followers of Christ. They relied on faith healing in lieu of medical treatment. Russ Briggs left the church after he buried 2 baby sons in this cemetery.
There's something about holding your child in your arms while it dies. It's terrible.
Professor Peters says the cases we hear about are only the tip of the iceberg.
It's sort of a hidden tragedy in communities that are not part of mainstream America. We just don't know what's happening to the kids in those church communities.
Until 1999, parents of kids buried here were not prosecuted because Oregon law had a religious faith healing exemption. Oregon closed the exception, but more than 30 states, including Wisconsin, still allow them. But that didn't stop the district attorney in Wisconsin from charging Kara Newman's parents with reckless homicide. And that's when Jill Farkas with the Christian Science Church stepped in. The church helped write the first law, which after the Newman arrest was viewed as protecting reckless parents. Now the church is proposing new legislation, which Farkas says will give children more protection.
We never intended it to be any way perceived as a shield for reckless behavior. So as people that were very much involved with that law, we always have wanted to protect children, and we felt we had to step in with a solution.
Our Father, which art in heaven.
Christian Science may be the largest and best known of all the faith healing traditions. The church has full-time paid practitioners who pray for the sick. Joe Farkas is one of them. He says healing represents a fundamental connection Christian Scientists have with God.
We expect a good outcome because we're praying to an all good God. We don't believe that suffering is ever the will of God, or that someone should die because it's God's will. We see that the outcome from successful prayer is always good.
Farkas says the legislation the church proposes is designed first to protect kids, but it also outlines a number of factors for a jury to consider, including the length of the illness. But Dr. Faust says the proposed changes only serve to protect the parents.
So if a child has been ill for a long time, then the prosecutor should say, well, let's see, she was ill for a long time. Maybe that gave the parents reason to think that this wasn't very serious because she hadn't died yet. The point is there should be no criteria, no special criteria for based on religious beliefs.
The bottom line, according to Rita Swan, is that the proposed law would actually make it more difficult to prosecute faith healers. Swan is the founder of Children's Health Care is a Legal Duty.
There's one condition about the child's age. Well, what does that mean? Does it mean that parents have no legal duty to get medical care for a teenager? The conditions are vague, they're contradictory, they're confusing to the jury. There's no state in the country that has a law like this.
Joe Farkas insists that the church would never dictate that Christian Science parents shouldn't seek medical care.
Our church does not have any strictures against seeking medical treatment, and it also does not shun any of the members if they do seek medical attention.
I'm not saying that the officials come and threaten you with a gun or with some terrible punishment, but the theology itself says that Christian Science is the only method that really heals disease.
But Rita's 16-month-old son Matthew died. Matthew had meningitis that was not diagnosed until it was too late, and she says not until her Christian Science practitioner finally told her to go see a doctor under the pretense that Matthew might have a broken bone. Rita and her husband ended up leaving the church, disillusioned about its teachings, the same teachings that continue to inspire Joe Farkas.
We have studied and read about the healings of Jesus, and Jesus demonstrated that all sorts of illnesses could be healed. I'm not walking on water, but I have seen things that have been quite dramatic, and I've read cases of things that have been dramatic.
Farkas says he witnessed his own wife's dramatic healing.
The doctors she went back to recommended that she have her uterus removed. Now, we didn't have any kids at that time, and that was quite a blow to hear that we couldn't have kids. So one night when my wife was praying, a sense of divine love was felt by her, and some words came to her consciousness. When she woke up in the morning, she was completely healed.
Farkas says Christian Scientists love their kids and would never be reckless with their health. But the church is opposed to another law the Wisconsin legislature will also be voting on this session that removes all religious faith healing exemptions, a law that Rita Swan supports.
I know in many cases parents are relieved. It takes the moral burden of decision-making off of the parents' shoulders. They've no longer broken a law of the church.
Dr. Foss says he would never discourage spiritual healing, that prayer plus medical care is probably better than either one alone. But the law, he says, needs to be there to protect helpless kids.
I don't think the point is to punish the Newmans, and I'm not in favor of sending them to jail if they are prosecuted. But I think criminal prosecution is a way of the state saying that we will we care about our children, we'll protect them.
There is no criminal intent. I mean, in all the hundreds of these cases that I've looked at, it's part of what makes them so tragic is that the parents are doing what they think is best for their children. And the punishment that they care about would be the punishment in the hereafter. That is what is significant.
If convicted, the Newmans could go to jail for 25 years, but faith-healing parents are seldom put behind bars. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Madison, Wisconsin.
On our calendar, Thursday, Western Christians celebrate Ascension Day, the observance of Jesus' ascent into heaven. And Friday marks a holy day for Baha'is, the declaration of the Bab. He was a co-founder of the faith who announced that he was the forerunner of a new messenger from God. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. There's much more on our website. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. And join us on our Facebook page for more on the Pope's Holy Land pilgrimage. You'll find a link to Facebook on our website.